Blog Talk Radio.
Out there. This is Sam Maxwell, the converted Mets fan, and you are here with the Metsian podcast, and we are so thankful on this Metsian off day that you are joining us this evening. I'm feeling pretty okay. Like I know that some Mets fans are still on edge. We've kind of been trained to do so during the month of June. But as we'll discuss, you know, even though things have tightened, this was one of the better months of June that we can remember in recent memories. So without further ado, let me bring on my co-conspirator on this podcast, one of my co-conspirators on this podcast, since Rich Farrago cannot join us this evening, and we wish him well out there. Mike LeColant down in Brooklyn, one of a fellow Brooklynite since I am currently in Flatbush. Mike, as always, welcome. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Hello, Sam. Hello, Mitzville. What's going on?
So maybe like sometimes when you and I are in Brooklyn, I think some of my podcast wires get crossed, and I always have to remember, oh, we're on the Metsian podcast, and you might hear some little glitches in the Sam system, but we're going to be okay. I don't think there's that many glitches in the Mets system, but of course we're trained a certain way, Mike. Only a block away from me, about a block over and one block down, is Mr. Gil Hodges, the late Gil Hodges, God rest his soul, Hall of Famer. He's resting in peace in Holy Cross Cemetery. And when I think of steady managerial hands over the course of the history of the New York Mets, I think still to this day, nobody it can be spoken on higher terms from a steady perspective than Mr. Gil Hodges. Davey Johnson was the next in line in terms of that steady hand, but that was also a very volatile era, which only gave us, I guess, similar to Gil Hodges' era, but that has an asterisk because of his untimely death, was only able to give us one championship during that period that there were so many expectations. I think that one of the reasons why I am so okay with the current Mets place, and of course the Phillies helped the Mets out tonight by giving them a half game over, at least over their closest competitor in the Braves, and now they stand at 3.5 going into July in first place. It's because of Buck Showalter, I think, one of the reasons why I feel the Mets are in such good hands. And I think when I think of the comparing and contrasting of other Mets managers and Gil in particular, regardless of Davey Johnson and his stature in Mets lore, Buck Showalter might be the closest from just a calm, cool, and relaxed leadership status of the manager since Gil Hodges. What do you think about that?
You know, Gil Hodges belongs in his own conversation. He's above and beyond, and I can't wait for coming ceremony to finally get him home where he belongs in Cooperstown in Baseball Museum and Hall of Fame. Managerial-wise, Sam, you know, Buck Showalter brings something that this team has been severely lacking over the last bunch of years. You want to go back to Mickey Callaway and all the nonsense that happened under, you know, his watch. Fast forward to Luis Rojas. And I'm not picking on the guy, but he didn't have the command and control, and he didn't rule the narrative and command the locker room the way Buck Showalter does. You see the camaraderie in that dugout on TV. I can't imagine what it's really like in the locker room. You saw him the other day. Steve Gelbs was cracking up because I guess they were trying to rip off Showalter's jacket or something to that effect. But they're all behind him in unison, whereas under previous managers, you saw players wandering off, creating their own narratives and doing, you know, their own and creating their own shenanigans, if you will. None of that's taken place. Think about the stupidity that's gone on and has emanated out of that locker room over the last couple of years, to include the Mickey Callaway years, to include the Luis Rojas years. None of that. None of that. And we're starting a new month, July. So, you know, you mentioned a lot of things. Thank you to the Phillies this evening for pounding out the Braves 14-4. That was timely considering that we had a day off today. So we gained a half game on them. And June, you mentioned that this is perhaps one of our better months of June over the last couple of years. And you're right about that. Go back to 2019, the Mets posted a 10-18 record. There was no June baseball in 2020. Last year, they broke out even 15-15. This year, they survived at least one game over par, 13-12 record. But the Braves, they went 21-5 in the month of June. And that's why our first place lead has shrunken to 3.5 games.
And you saw that the Mets coinciding with their West Coast trip, a very tough beginning to this month, the Braves were playing as easy of a schedule as it can get, and they took advantage of every single one of those games. I think that the month was a measure for the Mets as to where their status is regarding the league, but also the Astros were an interesting measure, and I think this is where things start to really get a little tenuous for Met fans' emotions, because had we just been able to get one, if not two games out of facing the Astros, we'd feel a little bit better going into the next month, because in most every single way, we got outclassed by them, who just probably have one of the biggest chips on their shoulders as any perennial contender can have because of 2017 and the way that it's perceived everywhere else. But that last game, of course, and I guess let's start with the last game the Mets played before going all the way back and doing an overview of the month. That was the most competitive they were with the Astros, yet they still, when it came down to the nitty-gritty, and unfortunately I wasn't able to really watch the details of it, but they got outclassed once more by the Astros, you know, just in the last inning.
Perhaps I'm in a forgiving mood this evening. You know, the Astros, sometimes baseball is a matter of who's hot and who's not. The Mets have their issues. They've got problems. Their pitching staff is compromised. We know that. They have issues. Houston's hot. All right. They beat us four games, two games and then two games. And you look at our run production, and I'll go in reverse order. The last game we played, we scored nothing. The game before that, we scored one. And then you rewind to that other two games we played over in Houston, we scored 3 and 2 runs. So the problem, you know, was we faced good pitching, but our hitting wasn't up to snuff. They're just hot right now. And I say that because I don't know if you checked other scores around around baseball, but Houston just did the same thing to the New York Yankees tonight. Yankees got the best record in baseball, and Houston defeated them 2-1. That's what they do.
Yeah.
It's what they're good at. They pitch. They pitch well. And right now they're hot, you know, and the Mets right now are performing a balancing act and just trying to survive these days until we get some reinforcement, better health, and better production. So, you know, I'm not taking the four Houston games that seriously as an indication of what might come. Instead, you know, we did well against the Miami Marlins, even though we lost in that terrible walk-off fashion. But we still took 2 out of 3. We could have taken that game. We didn't. But that's baseball.
Yeah.
So Houston, it is what it is. And that's where I am. Again, look what Houston did to the Yankees tonight. They're just a hot team right now.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, the interesting thing about the Astros and New York baseball, AL or NL right now, is that it's kind of a general narrative amongst New York baseball fans, is that the Astros are just getting on our nerves. And, of course, we have our own weird crossover history because of the Astros' former status of being in National League lore. So it's just such a funny team that has now become weirdly the primary rival, even outside of the boss of the Red Sox Yankees. The last few years, it's really just been the Astros and the Yankees are the ones that are such, have just created, because of the Astros crossing over, have created such a crazy rivalry because of perennial contenders in the course of the way the Astros have won. I also will throw this out there. Two very pitch-tight competitive games that ended in 2-0 losses for the New York Mets bookend the month of June, Mike, in the Dodgers. And Taijuan Walker was involved in that game to begin June, but basically this stretch of games, since the Mets did beat the Washington Nationals 5-0 on Wednesday, June 1st, but the Mets lost in 2-0 fashion in a very tightly pitched game with Taijuan Walker against the Dodgers, and then, of course, 2-0 against the Houston Astros.
Good pickup by you. You're right. But I will say that Taijuan Walker pitched excellently on Wednesday, and that was his third a really good start in a row. So I'm confident in his performance right now. And if you really look at the circumstances, he's carrying the staff right now. So I'm not going to begrudge Taijuan Walker for Wednesday's 2-0 loss to Verlander. That's what I'm not doing.
Let's go that direction, Taijuan Walker. I'm with you in terms of being confident that what he's going through this year, you know, similar in terms of his dominance of last year, but there's something that seems like he's working through the kinks with the idea of extension compared to last year. Because, of course, infamously, last year it wasn't until basically mid-August through the end of the season that he was able to kind of right the ship, coming out and ballooning his all-star caliber ERA. He is kind of the unsung hero right now, especially considering Carlos Carrasco has completely fallen off the cliff.
You're right about that. You know, last year, Taijuan Walker did not have a good second half. And right now, he's battling through that, you know, 3 months down, 3 to go. So far, so good. And he is, right now, he is the bull of the starting rotation. With all the injuries that we have to McGill, Carrasco now, you know, we're still waiting for DeGrom and Scherzer to come back. But Scherzer should be around the corner. Just completed his second rehab assignment. What was that, yesterday? I believe it was.
Yeah.
With Binghamton over against the Yard Goats in Hartford. So he should be back very shortly. But Taijuan Walker has been the bull. He's been pushing these guys along, and it's a good thing, too. And he's having a very good season, and he's persisting. That's the important thing, because, like I said, last year's second half didn't go so well.
Yeah, so – Mike, when looking at this month, you know, now we're entering almost halfway through what we're attempting to do, give or take, about 9:45. 9:45 right now. You are listening to the Mets Scene Podcast. So I'm going to ask you, Mike, to help with the direction of the latter half of this podcast. So when looking at this overall month, I'm going broad, is that they had a lot of impressive wins. They had some, I wouldn't say devastating, you know, no pun intended from the history of that word within the Mets lore. But there were some unfortunate, you know, brutal losses, if you will. And through all of that, you know, there were also some real blowout losses as well, where they just got absolutely shellacked. And of course I was talking somewhat about some of these Houston games, although they, you know, looking at one of them, they did that Wednesday game last week. It was a 5-3 loss, but it's just, sometimes I guess some of those Houston games just feel bigger than they actually are. And there were two games where the Houston Astros absolutely offensively dominated. But anyway, Mike, saying that, I'm going to let you take control. I went on a rant. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, you're right. I mean, there were a couple of blowouts. The Padres beat us 13-2. The Brewers beat us 10-2. You know, but we've shellacked a couple of teams as well. That's just baseball. If you lose a game 21-0, it's just one loss. If you win a game 23-2, it's just one win. So that doesn't, you know, pique my curiosity at all. Sometimes, you know, managers get to a point and they just let the rock roll down the hill and get bigger, you know. Sometimes you just throw in the flag in preparation of the next game. I'm not saying that's what Buck is doing, but every game is different. Every situation is different. You know, this harkens back to what I always say about April, Sam, and I guess May if you want. You can't win pennants in April, but you sure can lose them. And that's why, to me, good starts are always important. And in April, they went 15-7, and in May, they went 19-10. So that's 34-17 over the first 2 months. And that has allowed us to maintain this first-place lead and still, you know, struggle through the month with the 13-12 record, one game above par. That's what good starts do. They don't win you pennants, but they allow you to sustain and stay resilient and stay in the mix and keep things focused, you know, because if this was the other way around, here we are, we're just entering July, and there would have been a lot of despair over by Flushing by the Bay, if you know what I mean. But there's not, because we got up to that good start. So that protects us. It's insulation. So now we just need to pick up the offensive production. We need to get those two pitchers back and some general health and make that stretch run. This is baseball. This is what the regular season is all about. This is what makes it fun. Every season tells its own story. This is this season's narrative. You know, the absence of DeGrom, the absence of Scherzer, and how we've been battling with Tawan Walker. And if you look at Tawan Walker, and you look at Edwin Diaz, you look at Brandon Nimmo, those three guys, what do they all have in common as far as I'm concerned? Maturity. They're maturing before our eyes. And I think that makes a big difference. And that's why you need to just faith in these guys. And as you say, Sam, just keep pushing, because there's a different feeling about this club this year. That they're in it. They're in it for the long haul. There's no panic. There's a lot of confidence, and they're going out there and doing their job, you know. And the Gorilla Glue, as you started out the show, is Buck Showalter. He's the Gorilla Glue, keeping this all together, keeping the focus, and keeping everything on the straight and narrow. I haven't heard one controversial piece of BS emanate out of that locker room yet. And meanwhile, over the last couple of years, we had almost one per month, right or wrong.
Right. Right. And just thinking about that time that Jason Vargas got in a beat writer's face. Anyway. So now we enter July, taking on for this holiday weekend. I couldn't think of a better team to face the July 4th holiday weekend than the Texas Rangers. It's almost as if it feels like Toronto is from another country and the Texas Rangers are from the Republic of Texas.
They should be another country, right?
Yeah.
The Texas Rangers, my. You know what? More positivity, Sam. We're going to play Texas. Then we got Cincinnati, and then we got the Marlins again. Those three series, we should fatten up. And then we'll have the Braves.
And then?
Head-to-head confrontation, matchup, showdown. So we got to do well against the Rangers. We got to do well against Cincinnati. We absolutely need to do well against Cincinnati.
Yes.
And then we got the Marlins again, you know, division foe, four games. Let's keep at it. And then showdown with the Atlanta Braves in Atlanta. You know, that's what this is all about. That's what July is. That'll get us to the mid-month. And then we wrap up the month
of
July
the mid-month,
with the Yankees.
Speaking of mid-month, is there any better way to go into the All-Star break than three day games at Wrigley?
Yeah, that's great. You're right. It's a four-game series. The first one's at night, and then 3 days at Wrigley. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I didn't see that four-game part, but you're like that's beautiful that Wrigley Field still does. Starting on Friday. I mean, this is it. I'm pretty sure if I were to look at the Cubs, unless it's like an ESPN game takes over or a Fox game, but like maybe it's the status of the Chicago Cubs this year that lets this be still 220, or at least currently they're still scheduled for that. So maybe some of this stuff gets messed up and now I've just jinxed it. But again, like, That's baseball, Susan. You need some day games at Wrigley Field, and you need successive day games at Wrigley Field. Going to Cincinnati, 4th of July in Cincinnati at 6:40, which, again, just seems so weird that both Memorial Day and July 4th they've been scheduling these night games. It doesn't make any sense on a traditional standpoint. It's always been day games, but that's a whole other rant. My question for you, Mike, is it still Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati?
Is it still by name?
Let me see.
I will check
Cincinnati's. Yes, is it still by name Great American Ballpark?
That's a good question. I don't know.
And the survey says, it is still Great American Ballpark. So the Mets.
All right, good for them.
Now, mind you, yes, this is a company that I had never heard of before and I still don't know much about. But other than Wrigley Field, Mike, is there any better? Like, I thought they just called it Great American Ballpark originally, and then I found out it was a sponsorship. And it must be the greatest possible sponsorship name that could come with a ballpark, better than like Lone Depot Field or whatever the hell Miami has now. I liked it better when it was Marlins Park. Anyway, so at least the Mets are playing. At least I can get behind the Mets on the 4th of July playing in Great American Ballpark.
There
you
go.
With a classic National League franchise.
And the great national pastime. There you go.
So, we haven't seen the Cincinnati Reds. They've gotten better recently, Mike, if I'm correct, to their, record-breaking opening. And I'm going to look up exactly what their record is right now, but it's 26-48.
That's all relative. Yeah, they're 26-48, last place. So,
Right. They've kind of slowed their 62 Mets run down a bit, but they seem to have. I mean, like, just based off of the way they've been able to like kind of climb out of how awful they were for so long before the Angels kind of took their infamous lore from them with the 14-game losing streak, but. The Reds, they're in transition. We're seeing one of those early stages, but that doesn't mean they don't have talent.
No, but the case remains the same. The Mets need to do well against them. You know, the schedule is going to turn in their favor now, and they need to take advantage and then square up against the Braves.
It's going to be a big mid-July matchup. It's going to be exciting. It's happening in Atlanta, and there's one day game involved on Wednesday, July 13th. All the other games, Monday and Tuesday, are at 7:20 p.m. Mike, what else is on your mind before we go?
That's it, really. You know, tough times, but this is a tough team. I expect them to fight and get through this and improve. Let's hope Scherzer comes back at full health, and let's hope DeGrom gets back soon. And, you know, let's keep pushing. You know, Bryce Harper with Bryce Harper's injury. So that compromises the Phillies, you know, but again, this is what baseball is all about. This is what the regular season is all about. This is what summer is all about. Pennant races, you know. This is what childhoods are built on, you know. And for the young kids out there, for the 10, 12, 15-year-olds, summers like this are memorable, you know, and they'll talk about it for the rest of their lives. The older generation, you know, we compartmentalize and we categorize, but still shouldn't lose the sight that this is still a game and it should be fun.
So I don't think we're going to come back for July 10th at the earliest, looking at the schedule. So have to throw out there that Keith Hernandez, his number is going to be retired on July 9th. Day before we would potentially come back. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that congratulations to Keith Hernandez. Number 17 will never be worn by another New York Met. It hasn't probably at this point, and I'd have to look up the uniform numbers, and I will just to confirm, probably since Fernando Tatis, I would say. And even then, it was questionable to be giving it out. So what say you on Keith Hernandez retirement day?
Well-deserved, well-deserved. I remember reading the paper when they made the trade. I was so surprised. Just a happy day. I knew what he was, what he was capable of at that point of his career, and I couldn't believe he was coming to be a Met. You know, and he was a leader of that team, and I don't think they win a world championship without him. He nurtured the kids. He was here in 83. He helped Strawberry. He helped Gooden. He helped Darling. He helped all those kids come along. You know, Gary Carden didn't get here until 85. But for a year and a half, it was just Keith. So this is well-deserved. He's one of the most important players this organization has ever had.
So looking at the number, that will never be worn by another New York Met. It has been worn according to the ultimate number authority of Mets lore, and that's the word of the podcast is Mets lore, the phrase of the podcast. Ultimate Mets, 33 players have worn number 17. And before we go, I must list them. We'll go on a quick tangents here, Mike. But Don Zimmer was the first player to ever wear number 17. He wore it from April 11th of 62 to 5-6-62. Choo-Choo Coleman was next up wearing 17 for most of the remaining part of 62, as well as all of 63. Frank Larry wore it in a bit for a hot second in 1964. Dennis Rivens also in 64 to finish the season. Frank Larry again in 65 from April to July. Jimmy Schaefer in 65, July to October. Dick Stewart wore it in 66 till June. Larry Elliott of 66, July to finish the season. Don Bosch, 67 to August of 68. Rod Gaspar, and interrupt me if there's any names that come to mind whenever you hear them, Mike. Ted Martinez, Rod Gaspar, April of 69. Rod Gaspar was the world champion number 17 for the 69 team. Ted Martinez, July 1970 to August of 1970. That was quick. Rod Gaspar again in September of 1970. Ted Martinez, 71 to 73, July of 71 to start. And I'm just going to have to let you roll with this one, Mike, because I don't think you're not going to be able to say anything about, to say nothing, excuse me, about Felix Mian, who wore it from April of 74 till August of 77.
Felix Mian was my first big number 17. Was part of that 73 National League Championship team. Solid second baseman. I think all-star caliber. Was there for my, you know, childhood years. I was a big fan of him. Very distinguished at the bat, the way he choked up. Fine player, fine defensively. Got a lot of hits. For a little bit, he owned the record for most hits in a season.
Wow. I wish, I hope that Felix is going to be at Old Timers Day. So that would be very lovely. Gil Flores, September of 78 till September of 79. Funny to think of that. Jerry Morales, August of 80, the magic is back, till September of 1980. I wonder how his magic was. Ellis Valentine was the last player to wear number 17 before Keith Hernandez, June of 1981 till September of 1982. Any memories real quick of Ellis Valentine, the last number 17 before Keith wore it?
I was a big fan of Ellis Valentine when we acquired him. I thought he was just a great player with the Montreal Expos. The problem was he got hit in the face with the pitch, and it was never the same. Nonetheless, I was happy that he was playing in Shea Stadium. And he kind of reminds me, I would compare him to, why is this happening to me? 2005, 2006, left field. Why?
Oh, Jose Valentin?
No.
Okay.
He's on MLB Network, too. I can't believe I'm not remembering his name. This is so embarrassing because he's one of my most favorite players. This is what happens when you get old, man.
2005, 2006. We'll say it. Anyway, somebody out there, tweet at us if you can come up with who Mike is talking about. Because I'm not about the tangent.
I was a big fan of Ellis Valentine. I really was. I was happy to get him, but I knew he wasn't going to be the player he was with Montreal.
So also I should point out that the Ultimate Mets database has Ellis Valentine, ironically, as the 17th player in Mets history to wear number 17. Before the 18th player, Mr. Keith Hernandez, who first wore it on June 17th. Ha! So funny. 1983.
And by the way, the player I was trying to think about was Cliff Floyd.
Oh, God. Jesus. Especially, I don't know, I think, you know, when I said Jose Valentin, I still had Felix Mian in my head because I was thinking second baseman. But, yeah, outfielder, of course. duh. So people who tweeted us, you can tell us how crazy we were for not coming up with that right away. David Cone wore number 17 after Keith Hernandez, who last wore it on September 27, 1989. David Cone wore it from May of 91 to August of 92. I have to let you touch on David Cone real quick.
Cone, you know what? I'll never forgive him for writing that idiotic article in the newspaper in 1988. Let's just leave it at that.
Jeff McKnight.
Cone was a screwball. At least when he was.
Well, he follows me, so let's be careful. We're going to try to get him on here.
I mean that in a good way. You know, he was just, you know, part of a different.
Well, no,
brother.
I mean, I think it'll be. I think if we're ever so lucky to get David Cone, who I don't even know why he followed me. That it's just like, you know, you have those, like, you're like, what? But like, why just, like, even like when Jose Reyes followed me, I was like, what is going on? But with Cone, he seems like, you know, I guess comfortable enough with his career to explore that with you one way or another. We'll see. So Jeff McKnight was the next to wear it, and Mike, you know, he was number 17 in a season where I can only imagine he has the stats that every time he was up and did something poor, somebody would be like, and he's got to be wearing number 17.
You know what? That crossed my mind a couple of times that season. What a horrible season 93 was.
I gotta just see. He played 105 games, had 164 at bats, scored 19 runs, had 42 hits, had 2 home runs, 13 RBIs, walked 13 times, struck out 31 times, and had a .256 batting average. Yeah, I could see where occasionally, like when you see a .256 batting average with a .311 and so little at bats, you could imagine that occasionally. Some people were thinking what you were. So Brett Saberhagen from 4-4 1994 till 7-31 1995. I guess that was kind of the era of Brett Saberhagen trying to make up for some of his past transgressions with the media and just the terrible seasons that he was brought into.
Yeah.
What do you remember about 94 to 95 Brett Saberhagen?
You know what? He was still a very good pitcher. The guy didn't walk anybody, literally. So few walks. But he just got caught up in a bad team. You know, otherwise he could have been a standout pitcher for a better team, just not that team.
What do you, just real quick, total tangent, but 94, like, they were making strides, but it, you know, nobody ever talked about the fact that the Mets didn't get a chance to make a move in August and September, but they weren't really there. But do you ever wonder, like, what could have been for the last month and a half?
You know what? Everyone was still so hung over from 92 and 93. That 94,
right.
You know, we started to see, you know, Todd Hundley, but we were just so hungover, and even from the 80s, that run from, you know, 84 to 90, this was still the hangover period, especially in 93. So 94 is really a really faint blip on the Mets' radar. No one will ever really talk about 94 because it was really unremarkable, at least for the players that were on that team.
And when you think about it, it is pretty crazy to think that the Mets went from one of the greatest teams that everybody will talk about for the rest of baseball eternity, 7 years later, 103 losses. It's pretty crazy to think that.
What I remember most about those years wasn't on the field. It was in the front office because all those guys used to fight like cats and dogs. Joe McElvain, Jerry Hunsicker, Al Harrison was part of that. Obviously, you know, he paid for the worst team money can buy. You know, but those three guys and a couple of the other people in that office, they were all bickering with each other. And when they gave the job to Harrison, Jerry Hunsicker and Joe McElvain, they flipped out. They're like, how could you do that? And you saw they fled the organization. Hunsicker went to Houston, and McElvain went to San Diego. And let the Wilpons really no recourse when they had to, you know, fire Al Harrison, to the point where the Wilpons got on the phone and begged McElvain to come back. That's what stands out most to me about that season, 95-94. That's what stands out.
Right.
The front office chaos.
And back to the Wilpons, which I think is kind of part of, it's kind of part of the next era of number 17. That you can't escape the fact that this number kept getting handed out in the first place. So Brett Maine is the next one to wear number 17 from April of 96 to September of 96. Louis Lopez, June of 97 to September of 99. Mike Bordick wore it when he was traded for after Ray Ordonez went down in 2000 in July to October, of course, of 2000, last wearing it in the World Series on 10/26. Kevin Apier wore it from April of 2001 till October of 2001. Satoru Fumiyama, April of 2002 to September of 2002. Graham Lloyd, who is more known with the Yankees but pitched for the Mets in 2003, wore it till July. I'm guessing he got traded or something. I don't know. Jason Anderson wore it from August of 2003 till September. Wilson Delgado, August of 2004 to October of 2004. Dae-Sung Koo, and he does have a Mets moment. He does have a Metsian moment in number 17, Mike. Mike up.
Sorry. I can't tell you that I remember that moment. Not right now, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, so it's an easy YouTube look. They definitely have it on YouTube. He hit a double and then scored off of, like, Randy Johnson in 2005. and he's a pitcher. He wore the jacket, like, the entire it's a great little moment, and that's the only thing he's known for. Do you remember it now?
Vaguely.
Mike,
you know me. I watch a lot of games with one eye, man.
Oh yeah, no. So definitely, we'll have to tweet it at you, Dae-Sung Koo. The famous moment against Randy Johnson in 2005, where, you know, I think it was his first major league at bat. That's why it's one of those big isolated Mets moments. Jose Lima wore it in May of 2006 to July of 2006. You know, real quick, sad that, you know, the late Jose Lima, unfortunately, not very memorable Mets career, kind of gets grouped into what Omar was like trying to do with old, you know, lightning in a bottle pitchers, if you will. But I think that I always loved Jose Lima. I loved his 2004 with the Dodgers. And, you know, you can't go through this list without just giving a shout out to what seemed like a really cool and special fellow to know.
One of the greatest people on planet Earth ever. He was awesome to the fans, great to the fans. Gave them so much time and so much attention. I witnessed it firsthand. I got to talk to him a couple of times over at the visitor's dugout. I won't tell you why, but just watching him in action, incredible.
Yeah, so a big shout-out to the late Jose Lima, who was the 31st person in Mets history to wear number 17. And they gave it out to David Newhan, who is he a coach or no, I guess he was a player at the time. So he was the second to last. He was the penultimate number 17 before a relatively memorable Mets career, not exactly crazy memorable, maybe a little bit underwhelming, but like I remember, especially considering how 2008 went, I looked back at that season and said I really enjoyed Fernando Tatis on this team.
Yeah, you could say that. You could say that. The bitter taste
of
2008.
And with that, that's number 17. Exactly. And with that, he was the 33rd player to wear number 17. And at that point, even the Wilpons came to their senses. Especially considering at that point, and still, he's working for them.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, again, you know, we want to collectively thank Keith for not only his baseball service, which is why his number is being retired, but his overall service to this Mets franchise. I mean, every single day, Keith tells me something that I need to know about baseball. Every single day, Keith tells me something I didn't know about baseball. Every single day, Keith makes me laugh. Every single time there's a broadcast, he's pitch perfect, even when he's clearly phoning it in. And I love him for that. So thank you, Keith. Thank you, Mets, for retiring his number. And at 10:17 p.m., we will start to segue off the Metsian podcast. And we're so thankful that you are listening to the Metsian podcast. And with that, I proceed to our final word. And first, I guess, shameless plugs. Mike.
Shameless plug. Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. Pay a visit. Google it. Find it. Hang out. That's it, man. Let's go Mets. That's my final word. All is well. Sleep well. Don't let anxiety get the best of you. Everything will be all right. We'll be in good shape, and then, you know, we've got to paint the race. The laws of baseball will take over. But for now, be cool.
To quote one of our favorites, Taryn the Coop Cooper, post-traumatic Mets disorder. Remember you have it. Heed Mike's words, calm your anxiety down, and let's go Mets. Take care, everybody. Happy end of June.
Good night, all.